afternoon to the House Committee on Land Use and Regulatory Fairness. We are honored to have with us today Governor John A. Kitzhaber, M.D. Welcome, Governor, to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Kitzhaber. I hold the position of Governor of the State of Oregon. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to come down here before you today, and I appreciate both the gravity of your task and your willingness to undertake it. I believe that successfully addressing Measure 7 legislatively this session is the responsible course for us all to take. We're now roughly 2 months into the legislative session and 4 months removed from the election. And we have all spent time around the state listening to a variety of Oregonians and forming, I'm sure, diverse opinions on the result of that input. Based on the conversations that I have had with citizens and with community leaders and representatives of business and labor and environmental organizations, I've arrived at certain broad conclusions that will guide my thoughts as these issues are fleshed out. So I would describe the framework for decision-making, at least from my view, as follows. First, compensation legislation must be fair. It must be fair to taxpayers, must be fair to landowners, and it must be fair to all Oregonians. In other words, we need to recognize that there is a legitimate claim to compensation when property is unfairly devalued. Legislation must provide compensation for that property, for those property owners, but must also, in my view, delineate where the money for this compensation will come from and how much money should be budgeted for this activity. Second, I do not believe that legislation should force a rollback of our current environmental laws and our current land use laws. That is simply not what Oregonians were voting on last November. Oregonians voted for compensation, and it is compensation that we must build into our system in a fair and equitable way. The fact is that there remains a strong public sentiment to preserve farm and forest land for our natural resource-based industries, to maintain residential zoning and neighborhood character, and to continue strong and effective efforts to clean up our air and our water. And I believe that those public sentiments must be respected in this process. Third, we need to provide a means to pay compensation claims that does not force implicit reductions in other important public services, such as education or public safety or services to the frail elderly. Now, certainly there is room for reasonable people to debate the level of funding for state and local services. But reducing this funding should be openly debated and explicitly determined on the merits and not be simply an implicit consequence of paying compensation claims. Mr. Chairman, this committee faces, as you know, a very difficult task in creating a fair system of compensation and designing new ways of dealing with state and local regulations that are associated with this issue. The primary watchword for this job is fairness, as your committee name implies. I certainly admire you, particularly you, Mr. Chairman, for your willingness to undertake this task, and I offer my full support and participation of your efforts. Oregon has an admirable record of reaching within itself in times of challenge and finding innovative and creative solutions, and I believe this is certainly such a time. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. We appreciate you taking the time to come down here. I want to be respectful of your time. We know you're busy. I would like to see if the committee has any specific questions they might pose. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Kitzhaber, will you discuss the lot of record issue and if there's any room to move in your view on that issue?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I am actually very familiar with this issue. We spent a lot of the time that I was in the legislature discussing it. We had a bill in 1991, Senate Bill 91, in fact, my last session that essentially attempted to deal with this issue and the issue of secondary lands. It died in the waning days of the session, but a bill did pass in 1993, House Bill 3661, which essentially was a direct result of those discussions. That bill allowed the siting of a dwelling on certain parcels of farmland, and between 1993 and 1999, 657 lots of record have been approved and more, I'm sure, have been approved since 1999. In 1997, as you recall, we passed Senate Bill 379, which allowed essentially the same provision for certain parcels of forest land. So I will say, on the one hand, I believe we have taken substantial steps to address that issue and to strike a balance between allowing people an opportunity to build on a parcel of resource land while still maintaining or recognizing the fact that without a non-urbanized ag and forest land, you cannot sustain a natural resource industry in Oregon. Am I absolutely opposed to any more discussions? No. But I do believe we have taken substantial steps towards addressing that issue.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for the governor? I find it sort of odd, Governor, that we get you here and awfully silent at this point. I guess I would just generally, one of the questions, and I guess I'm interested in your feedback on this a little bit. One of the questions that's posed, and you certainly raised it in your remarks, about the need for identifying some source by which we would compensate. My position on that has been to acknowledge that that's a discussion we have to have. It's certainly not one that was had in the context of Measure 7, and I don't think that people are necessarily obligated to have that discussion, but I think good government people and who believe in sort of a balanced solution, we've got to have that conversation. My opinion, though, Governor, has been that we need to have that sort of at the end of the discussion after we've defined the parameters of the policy debate, so we can then sort of size up what it is that we would actually be funding and then have the discussion about where the money would come from. I guess I'm interested in your response generally to that approach, acknowledging that that's a discussion we have to have, but essentially leaving that to the end to see if we can work out the policy differences.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with that. I mean, you can't not have that discussion because this is about compensation. Compensation is about resources. I do think you are wise to try to sort of frame the debate and focus a little more on the circumstances under which you would be providing compensation, because that's going to have a direct relationship to the amount of resources needed, which then will put some sideboards on the possibilities. I do think, if I might, Mr. Chairman, just point out I think it's important when we talk about compensation that we not lose sight of the fact that there are a number of provisions in existing law under which the state does, in fact, provide compensation, things from purchasing right-of-ways to tax deferrals and abatements. And it's not an insignificant sum. ODOT spent $45 million on purchasing right-of-ways last year. In the last biennium, or the one we're in right now, tax deferrals for farm use were about $117 million, and for forest land, almost $40 million. So I think we need to recognize that we do have some elements of this, and I appreciate that doesn't address some of the concerns raised under this measure, but I do think it needs to be considered in your, mm-hmm. your deliberations.
Okay, good. Thank you. Representative Beck?
I guess I will ask a question then, if you want some. We've had a number of measures in the past decade that the courts have thrown out, determined to be unconstitutional. I can think of, I think, one or two. I'm thinking campaign finance reform, which passed 75%, 70 or 72% support. There was another, I think, a public employee-related measure or dues measure. I can't remember what it was. I think both of those were, the legislature chose not to address a couple of issues that the courts subsequently determined were unconstitutional. Where would you put how would you frame whether we should or shouldn't, or why this is different, why this measure might rise to a level that we really should take an aggressive look at versus some other measures that we've chosen not to address the will of the voters? That's a hard question, maybe. But.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, I think that this is an issue. It's a complicated issue. but I think it is one that commands the public attention. I don't think if you did an open-ended poll today and asked people what the top five issues are, that that takings would be in the top five. But if you asked them, you know, I think you'd find, you know, energy crisis and public education. But if you ask them specifically about this issue, it is an issue of concern. And I think it's a combination of a basic fairness question about the loss of value of private property, which I think is a very legitimate issue. And that's one of the reasons we have some provisions in our law today to address that, in condemnation statutes and in the requirement to purchase right-of-ways. I also think there's a concern with regulations in general, whether or not they affect compensation or the value of people's property. It's the counter fatigue, if you will. And I think that if we don't address this issue, it will be addressed through the ballot in a way with a whole host of unintended consequences. And I believe that the vote was a real vote. There's a real concern that the voters are registering out there. I don't believe that it is, as I said, about our land use program or environmental laws. I think it's an issue of fundamental fairness. And I think we have an obligation to attempt to try to address that in a responsible and balanced fashion through the legislative process, if at all possible. I don't think it will go away if by ignoring it, I guess.
Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Governor. I'm concerned about one avenue of suggestion that we hear an awful lot, and that is to just simply do the best we can with this at this point in time, but basically let it wind its way through the courts. And the reason I'm concerned about us not taking direct and dramatic action at this point in time is that things are kind of slowing up. In fact, things have come to a screeching halt in terms of development and planning in some municipalities because they don't know what to do, and they're holding up on things, applications and so forth. I fear that if we sit back and let this go through the courts, it's going to be at least 2 years before it winds its way up to the Supreme Court. What do you think about a stalling tactic?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I don't think that's prudent. I mean, I personally, not being a constitutional lawyer, but being somewhat familiar with Armada as I was named in that case, I think that the chances of this being declared unconstitutional on those grounds are fairly good. So, I mean, if I was just a betting person and thought this was the end of the issue, one could make the argument, let's just let the courts decide this. But I don't, you know, I think there's a legitimate issue here. And the larger question is, do we believe that there's a fundamental fairness question involved? And do we believe we can address it in a way that doesn't undermine other values that Oregonians hold dear, which I believe is their natural environment and our ability to manage growth in a reasoned fashion? I would say that we can, or at least we have an obligation to try, and simply sitting and twiddling our thumbs until the court makes a decision, I think, furthers the chaos, raises fundamental questions about the ability of our legislative institutions to solve problems. And I think it's an abdication of our responsibility. So, I'm very pleased that your chairperson has been willing to take this on and that you are willing to sit down and debate this because it's not going to be easy, but I think it's very important.
Thank you. Any other questions? Governor, again, we appreciate you taking your time out of your schedule. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your comments. Next on our agenda, we're going to ask the Oregon Association of Realtors to come forward.
All of them?
You shouldn't feel bad that half the room left after the last speaker. Certainly isn't an indication of the quality of your testimony, I'm sure.
No, I appreciate that.
Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I have with me today Harlan Levy, Staff Attorney for Government Affairs. We have a few prepared comments, and then we're both available to answer any questions that you have. Oregon Association of Realtors is a business trade association with more than 12,000 members in Oregon. Our members help people buy and sell real estate. We took no position on Measure 7. We took no position because, like other business groups, we were concerned with the wording of the measure and its potential impact on our communities. Realtors support zoning. Realtors recognize coordinated land use planning can benefit this state, its communities, and its citizens. At the same time, realtors have long known and been concerned about the heavy burden that the land use system, as it has evolved, places upon real property owners. It therefore did not surprise us when our business clients and customers passed Measure 7. Only those who take a completely ideological view of land use planning could miss the growing sense in this state that the system, while noble in its conception, has become the providence of a handful of planning insiders bent on using the system to dictate how other people should live. OAR did not support Measure 7 because the measure created a risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That doesn't mean that we didn't want to get rid of the bathwater, only that we wanted to keep the baby. The baby, as far as we're concerned, is livable communities with predictable and stable real estate markets. Zoning and planning play legitimate roles in achieving these goals. But when planning and zoning regulations go too far by creating undue burdens and hardships on landowners, the regulations themselves undermine communities and destabilize markets. The passage of Measure 7 sends the message that a majority of the voters in this state believe that the burdens and hardships created are no longer fair. That is not necessarily a cry for compensation. It is, however, and you've heard the individual citizens most impacted say so, a clear cry for relief. Taxing citizens who complain of unfair burdens caused by excessive regulations in order to keep in place the unfair regulations is not a prescription for solving the problem. In fact, given the public's equally clear message about the burden of taxes, it's a prescription for failure. Having listened to affected citizens and those who've testified here, we've reached the conclusion that there are two kinds of land use regulation unfairness. Individual voters may have been responding to one or the other or both. First, and you've heard from a number of these citizens, there are specific individual applications of regulations that place an undue and often unintended burden or hardship on an individual property owner in circumstances that most people would agree is unfair. Thus, a person who's residentially zoned and taxed property is made unbuildable by various environmental overlays without regard to the actual impact of the proposed use or the possibility of mitigation, can legitimately claim an undue and unfair burden or hardship. As the land use system has grown more complex and pervasive and interacted with equally complex and pervasive state and federal environmental laws, there have been more and more of these unintended burdens and hardships. Each of these real people subjected to these real burdens have family, friends, co-workers, and relatives. At some point, there arises a perception within a significant portion of the population that the system is not predictably fair. The other side of the fairness question, we think, is more of a systemic unfairness. Senate Bill 100 was the result of compromises. Benefits and burdens were apportioned. Certain groups have worked to redistribute those benefits and burdens. Some of that redistribution has been based on ideology and some on greed. Power has shifted to unelected state bureaucracies as state goals and goal guidelines have become detailed state zoning regulations, which tie the hands of local planners, dictate lifestyles, and protect preferred interest groups. The result is that citizens cannot access or influence the real decision makers, nor find any redress outside of this body for their grievances. The members of this panel know well what I'm talking about. You hear every term from both the interest groups and the disenfranchised citizens. Hundreds of land use bills are introduced. Dozens are passed. Some sections of state law now contain more exceptions than rules. Every 2 years, this body changes the rules. In the interim, DLCD changes them back or finds ways to limit their reach. The result is a system that, while valued in the abstract, hence you get the poll results that say people support land use planning, it's not perceived as necessarily fair in application. With the speaker's admonition that this panel honor the intent of the voters and remain focused on Measure 7 issues, we would like to propose and pledge our support for a two-pronged approach to resolving the problems created by the passage of Measure 7 in its present form. First, we think a simple constitutional amendment that enshrines the citizens' concerns about regulations going too far and resulting in a taking of private property is possible. Other states have done that without finding it necessary to enshrine a detailed list of definitions and procedures in their constitutions or creating windfalls or new budget-breaking rights that require increased taxation. We can do as well here in Oregon. Coupled with that amendment should be a state variance law. Such laws are part of every land development ordinance in the state. They appear in state environmental statutes. They're common in administrative rules that deal with property rights, like access to highways. In short, variance procedures are well-understood ways to relieve specific individual burdens and hardships where those burdens and hardships are unnecessary or undue. Local variance ordinances universally start with these words. The county may vary or modify requirements of the land development ordinance where strict application would cause an undue or unnecessary hardship. Isn't that exactly what fairness means? Consideration of the impact of the rules on the specific individuals where that makes sense. Variance laws were designed to prevent takings claims. When you change the definition of taking as Measure 7 has done, it's completely logical to revisit the idea of variances. LCDC Chairman Pfeiffer mentioned this approach to this panel in his testimony last week. We believe a constitutional amendment adding the decrease of value to the definition of taking, coupled with a variance statute that gives local governments the flexibility to administer land use regulations in a reasonable manner, will meet the voters' concerns without getting into a futile attempt to find a new funding or waive land use laws across the board. Extreme solutions to an extreme ballot measure are not going to solve anything. The approach I've outlined is a workable way, we believe, to deal with the unintended individual injustices that result from our current land use system. It does not, however, address the much more intractable problem of systemic unfairness. That unfairness is not completely accidental. It's the result of years of political maneuvering by all concerned with land use. The much-touted design of Senate Bill 100 is now barely perceivable beneath the layers and layers of tinkering brought by the past 28 years. It will take the honest efforts and goodwill of people from all perspectives to relieve the pressures being created by the systemic unfairness that has crept into our land use system. It may not be possible. If it is, it won't be accomplished overnight. But without the effort, we'll see the son of seven and the son of seven and so on. The problem is large. But maybe the property tax wars have taught us all that the consequences of failing to address a difficult issue in a reasonable manner is the voters resolving the issue with a sword rather than a scalpel. We would like to propose that this committee make a part of the solution to Measure 7 to be a comprehensive review of the land use system between now in the next legislative session.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Harlan, are you planning to testify or are you just here to help respond to questions?
Chair Williams, I'm just here to help with questions.
Okay, good. Start with Representative Schrader and then Representative Morgan.
I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the simple constitutional initiative that doesn't have funding or definitions that would address this issue. Flesh that out a little bit for us. That sounds...
I would add just the definition of regulation or of the impact of regulations. Go ahead, Harlan.
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, if you look at some of the constitutions of some of our other states, they do have in their takings provisions a requirement that landowners be compensated for damage. So Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon Constitution, which currently reads, the government shall not take private property without paying just compensation, could be amended to include the word damage. The government shall not take nor damage private property without payment of just compensation. Then there are ways to limit that. You could throw a percentage in there. You could do there's ways to tinker with it in a very simplistic manner so as to not upset some of the recent rulings that the Supreme Court or that the courts have said required for a constitutional amendment to be valid.
Follow up, sir?
Follow up.
So we would have to put some definitions, some percentages, some things in the Constitution to make that your proposal work.
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, you would not necessarily have to. It's one possible solution. other states do not have the percentage in the Constitution themselves, where they do have it in the implementing legislation. For example, the state of Texas has a damage clause in their state constitution, but in their implementing statute, they do have a definition of that that requires that the property be devalued by more than 25%.
Follow-up, sir?
Yes.
If we go to this implementing legislation, then don't we run afoul of the potential for the same bureaucratic problems that you were alluding to before, where the different agency groups could misinterpret that, so to speak? That's been, I think, one of the issues that I hear about out there, is that there's been different interpretations and of what the legislative intent was, or the constitutional intent for that matter.
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, you're right, but we would just have to trust this body to deal with that issue. And, you know, from session to session, obviously, political winds change, and that's something that we would have to look at. But we think that it is a possible solution to get us out of this box.
Last comment, sir?
Yes.
Just could we get some examples of, from those, like there's three or four states that have the provisions you're talking about, if you could get us some of those examples and some of that implementing legislation that you're talking about, that would be helpful.
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, I'd be happy to provide that to this committee.
Thank you, Harlan. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was somewhat parallel to Representative Schrader's. I was very interested in having you flesh out the variance aspect to this. And then the other question that I had was, I'm wondering whether the real estate folks had addressed the compensation issue and what your thoughts on that was.
Chair Williams, Representative Morgan. Variance law is well-established law in zoning. What it says is that when the application of a particular regulation would result in undue hardship, usually resulting in a taking or a wipeout, then that provision will be waived for that particular property. It does not mean that anything goes. It means that, you know, for example, setback provisions would still apply. You'd get to build your house, but you wouldn't, you know, get to build your house, you know, right on the road. You'd have to still abide by some of the other restrictions, but you would still be able to get the house. It's used to prevent undue hardships. Most local codes do have a provision built in for that purpose.
And so, may I have a follow-up?
Oh.
Do you see, then, the compensation aspect being the granting of a variance?
Representative Williams, or Chair Williams, Representative Morgan, that would be one option the local government would have. Not necessarily the only option. Other states, such as the state of Florida, have a laundry list of various items that the government may do in order to prevent the wipeout. One of those things would be the variance. Another thing would be compensation, right? Check. But there are other things that are built in as well that provide flexibility.
Thank you.
Representative Beck and then Representative Close.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess my questions are similar, just sleuthing out some more. You had some intriguing concepts. You talked about the issue of enshrining in the Constitution some kind of language related to the decrease in value, in property value. From your perspective, when is a government regulation, you know, what percentage? I mean, this is on this great continuum we talked about last week. You know, if government agency regulates something and the landowner perceives their property has been diminished 5% in value or 90% in value, where would you draw the line? When should something be done?
Chair Williams, Representative Beck, we've been part of the work group for the past 8-plus weeks, and we've had that dialogue over and over, and I'm not sure there's a very easy answer there. There are a variety of perspectives. Some of the members of the committee wanted to assign a straight percentage. Others felt that a percentage with a minimum dollar value, that at a certain investment point, 25% was too much, for example. If you have a $200,000 project versus a $2.5 million project, there's significant difference by using a percentage standpoint. I don't know that there's an easy answer there. There are a variety of, we've seen everything in looking in other states from 10% to, is it 40%? To be a range in that has been what's been commonly accepted, but that's pretty large variance. 20 to 25% seems to be more typical.
If I can clarify, Mr. Chairman.
You may.
That's a threshold, so mm-hmm. anything more than 20 to 25% yes. in loss and value. Do you specifically have, I mean, you said the work group. I haven't been invited to the work group, so I don't know who the work group is or what they're doing, but what do you think? What are the, or you, realtors, do you have a position since you're in front of us here? What do you guys think?
I can tell you whatever I think. No. The realtors haven't defined a particular number.
Well, another question, sure, different line. You talked about livable, one of your goals at the outset of your testimony was sort of promoting livable communities. Was that the word, phrase you used? Would it be fair to say that from the realtor's perspective, again, you also mentioned environmental overlays as one of the areas of concern that seem to be of significant concern to a lot of the situations you're addressing. I'm wondering whether it would be fair to say that the realtor's concerns tend to be with regulations that have been enacted inside communities, inside urban growth boundaries versus outside.
Representative Williams, or Chair Williams, Representative Beck, we have realtors from every community in this city, in this state, and so we have a variety of perspectives on that particular issue. I don't think you could say that we are specifically interested in those kinds of issues within an urban growth boundary. We have a significant number of our leadership is from the rural areas, and they see significant issues with the way that state land use planning has been enacted and the effects of that. So I don't think you could define it as either a rural or an urban issue to us particularly.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in this 25% damage amount that you mentioned in Texas. I've been told that our courts in Oregon have taken a percentage that they consider a taking, that it has to be at least 80%. Is that correct? And how did that evolve?
Chair Williams, Representative Close, I'm not familiar with that. The way that the Oregon courts have interpreted the takings clause of the Oregon Constitution is the same way that the federal courts have interpreted the federal Constitution, which requires all economically viable use of the property be taken away in order for it to become a compensable taking. There's a difference between a taking, a regulatory taking, which could be any depreciation, and a compensatory taking, which requires that the government write you a check.
Follow up. So you're saying in Oregon that it's been, in your view, it has to be 100%? Has that been the case?
Chair Williams, Representative Close, that has been the case.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel?
Yes.
Representative Schrader.
I don't want to blab we got out of the testimony. The other states you're referring to, most all of them have a much more limited universe they're dealing with. It's either forest land or forest and ag land. Oregon's Measure 7 was different than that. Are you suggesting we go more to what the other states have?
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader. You are correct. Some of the states limit it to various types of land. However, Texas and Florida are two of the states that we've been spending a lot of our time on, and that's any regulation applicable to any land. Our interpretation is that this Measure 7 was aimed at land use regulations. The universe of land use regulations is pretty broad in the state. So we think that what the voters said was that they want relief from excessive land use regulations, and that is what we would hope that this committee and this legislative body ends up writing into law.
Vice President.
Last question.
You indicated that you didn't think it was going to take a lot of funding to take care of this. Perhaps the variance and some other measures that other states are using would be applicable on the way out. Those same states, all their takings measures were prospective, and it would appear that that's how they're able not to have to have a huge funding source. Is that something the realtors are looking at also?
Chair Williams, Representative Schrader, we've certainly had a lot of dialogue on that. It's difficult to start at this point and just suggest that we can only look at it prospectively.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next panel will be from the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Who's going to go first? Hi, Tim.
Hi. Chairman Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek, and I'm the General Counsel of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And the Farm Bureau is the state's largest general agricultural trade association. We have a long history of involvement in land use and property rights issues, particularly as they affect agricultural lands. I'd like to begin with a short discussion, I hope a short discussion, on property rights, because I think it leads naturally into and sets up very well how Farm Bureau views Oregon's land use planning system and how the legislature might consider some changes in the area of compensation in the wake of ballot measure 7. The issue of property rights is often discussed without first acknowledging that different notions exist concerning what property rights means. There are really two main perspectives at the heart of the definitions of property rights. Although some adhere to one absolute perspective or the other, in reality, the American concept of property rights has evolved over time and will likely to continue to evolve in the future. A reasoned analysis of the takings law jurisprudence shows the concept of property rights has changed over time. Early Supreme Court decisions involving property rights followed what political scientists and law professors call the classical liberal perspective, as represented by James Madison and Chief Justice John Marshall. In a nutshell, classical liberals believed individual property rights were critical to the development of society and called for stringent protections. Arthur Lee, an early Federalist, said, and I quote, "The right of property is the guardian of every other right, and to deprive people of it is in fact to deprive them of their liberty." The classical liberal or federalist perspective of property rights was embodied in early Supreme Court cases like the 1795 case concerning the Contracts Clause called Van Horn's Lessee versus Dorrance. The case involved a Pennsylvania statute attempting to resolve land claims by quieting title in one group of settlers. Finding the law unconstitutional because it failed to adequately compensate affected individuals for their loss of title, Justin Patterson said, quote, "The right of acquiring and possessing property and having it protected is one of the natural, inherent, and inalienable rights of man." Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin expressed an alternative Republican with a small r viewpoint. Although it would be a mischaracterization to suggest that individuals like Jefferson didn't have a strong sense of the need to protect private property rights, the Republican concept is that these rights are the product of society and, as such, are subject to certain limitations imposed for the public good. Where the Federalists saw individual rights, would say individual rights are the cornerstone of society, the Republicans would say society is the source for all individual rights. And that's the nub. This Republican concept of property rights was adopted by the Supreme Court in 1887 in a case called Moogler versus Kansas. At issue was a state law that prohibited selling or manufacturing alcoholic beverages. Mugler, who owned a brewery, sued the state, claiming that the law constituted a taking. Rejecting the claim, Justice Harlan wrote that laws that simply restrict uses of land for the public good cannot be deemed an appropriation of property worthy of compensation. Reflecting on these two views of property rights, Professor Jerry Anderson from the Drake University Law School writes in his article, Property Rights and Historical Perspective, quote, property rights should really be understood as a balance between these competing interests. The pendulum has gone back and forth in the Supreme Court between these two perspectives over the years. The shifting winds on the Supreme Court are probably best exemplified by two different cases with almost identical fact patterns that reach completely different results. On the one hand is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes adopting the Federalist perspective in the 1922 case, Pennsylvania Coal versus Mahon. In Mahon, the court invalidated a law that prevented coal companies from mining in a way that might affect the stability of the surface property. In it, Holmes said, if society wants to do this, it must pay the affected company whose property was taken. On the other hand, Justice Stevens, expressing the Republican perspective in a factually similar 1986 case, Keystone Bituminous Coal Association versus De Benedictus, dealing with bituminous coal rather than anthracite, found that no taking had occurred because the public interest in maintaining surface stability outweighed any individual harm. Arguably, the pendulum has swung back again to the Federalist perspective with current Supreme Court cases like Lucas v. South Carolina Coastal Council and others. The above discussion of property rights shows that how property rights are defined are not set in stone. I would argue that the same tension in defining property rights that the Supreme Court has long wrestled with is very much evident in this state as well. Although there is much disagreement about what Measure 7 said, the one thing that appears to be clear is that the voters told policymakers that the state needs to realign its view of property rights back toward individual freedom and more compensation when this freedom is restricted through regulation. Obviously, this issue has generated a lot of interest from different groups and individuals. Although the above discussion is not new to those involved in property issues, I argue it is helpful for all interested parties to continually assess where their philosophies fall in this philosophical spectrum relative to property rights. Only after identifying and realizing the perspective from which we look at property rights can we begin to identify areas of common ground upon which we can build broad-based consensus. The Oregon Farm Bureau comes to the property rights issues from a more federalist perspective, realizing the need to protect and preserve individual freedoms to the greatest extent possible. We also realize this position is not absolute. Given the historical fluidity of how property rights are viewed by the courts, we believe the government should enact laws and regulations to help define, to the greatest extent possible, what property rights are and how property can be used. In doing so, when property owners face an unexpected loss in property value, they should be compensated. Individual owners of property should, as much as possible, be made aware of limitations on the use of their property before coming into ownership. The adoption of planning zones establishes expectations for the use of land. However, zoning is not an exact science. Population growth, technological advances, and changing social mores will always call for changes in zoning. When the public at large or society calls for these changes in land use for the public good, individual property interests may be set aside. However, when this occurs, the individual should be compensated for any loss they may incur. Taking this approach one step further, when land is zoned for a particular use, then uses consistent with its zoning should be permitted in the least intrusive manner possible. For example, take a farmer in an EFU zone. Since the land is zoned for farming uses only, any restriction imposed on the land that decreases its value for agricultural production should trigger compensation. However, no compensation should be due a landowner in an exclusive farm use zone for regulations that prohibit him or her from using the land for a non-farm use. The same principle applies in any zone, whether it is industrial, commercial, residential, farm, or forest. The Farm Bureau believes a solution that adopts this approach is consistent with the message voters expressed with Measure 7. Although property rights are not absolute, voters seem to have indicated that, in the words of Justice Holmes, our current regulations are going too far and some compensation is necessary. the legislature should adopt a method to compensate individuals whose property rights have been infringed upon in a manner that they could not have foreseen when they acquired their property, but that still maintains the core concepts of our land use planning system. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Tim. Don?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I can't improve on the discussion on property rights, and I'll dwell a little bit more on the practical aspect from Farm Bureau's perspective. During the general election, the Oregon Farm Bureau took a neutral position on Measure 7, and we did that for three very good reasons. Number one, Farm Bureau policy adopted by our 99-member House of Delegates supports compensation for regulatory taking. When a farmer or a rancher's land is in the exclusive farm use zone, the primary activity required in that zone is farm use. If producers, by any action of any level of government, prohibit in any way farming activity, then the producer is due just compensation. Number two, Farm Bureau policy also strongly supports the principle of land use planning as a means of protecting the agricultural infrastructure necessary for farmers and ranchers to produce commodities in an efficient and profitable manner. There are, of course, forces outside your jurisdiction that have an influence on the profitability factor, and that is what our tractor rally last week was all about. However, without land use planning, it would be very, very difficult to even entertain the possibility that agriculture would be a significant part of Oregon's economic fabric. And the third reason we were neutral on Measure 7 is because it did not provide a method for funding the compensation for regulatory taking. Without sufficient funds for compensation, the effectiveness of the land use planning laws would be in doubt. The Oregon Farm Bureau does not support just one or the other. We support both. Without a method of funding compensation, the possibility was to lose both. We did not see that as a viable option. Actually, a fourth concern of the Farm Bureau is that some of the regulatory takings that might affect us the most were exempt from compensation. It is our opinion that all manner of taking in a zone should be compensated. We cannot be inconsistent and choose to compensate some takings and not others. A taking occurs when it is decided by some level of government that a certain limitation is for the general benefit of society. It follows then that compensation for the limitation is the responsibility of all of society subject to that level of government, not just the responsibility of the party whose right was taken. Mr. Chairman, this is a very important issue to the agricultural community that we represent. We want you to know that the Oregon Farm Bureau stands ready to assist you and your committee in finding a solution to this important issue that is fair to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Don and Tim both. Questions for either?
Okay.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, I just want you to comment on something that has come to mind with your discussion of Thomas Jefferson. In the Declaration of Independence, he talked about inalienable rights, and I believe that means non-transferable rights. And he said that those were granted by the Creator, which is part of our historical documents. He referred to a Creator granting inalienable rights, and he talked about, and he listed them as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'm told in the original document, at least I've read this, that it was life, liberty, and property that were inalienable. So I guess the idea is, and I know it's been eroded over the centuries, but that there's a power above government, and that transferring rights of property to government without compensation, that's why you have compensation, because it's an inalienable right to own property. So I guess I want you to comment on Thomas Jefferson, what he was getting at there.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Close. Thomas Jefferson is interesting. His outlook on it, you're absolutely right. The original theory, as developed by John Locke, was that individuals have the right to life, liberty, and property. Jefferson spent a great deal of time immediately after the Revolution in pre-revolutionary France, and he saw the way the French government was set up, and that large landowners had their land lay fallow while people were starving. And he saw that obviously the society, good of society, was not being achieved in that concept, and was concerned about how that might play out in the United States as it was developing. So Jefferson certainly had a strong notion of property rights. He was a property holder himself, and thought that for the American society to best serve purposes of democracy was for it to be made up of small landowners and primarily in an agrarian state. So he was concerned about the inalienable rights of property, and that there was some balance to be put in there for the good of society. And I think if you read some of the early discourses between Madison and Jefferson, they were very close friends, but had, I think, very different views of property rights and other things. So I don't know if that addresses your question.
Well, brief follow-up. I guess the idea of compensation, then, how does that fit into his thought?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I don't, you know, in my readings of Jefferson, I don't know that he ever expanded upon that. Certainly, I think it would be an error for someone to say that Jefferson was somehow adopting socialist concepts and reducing the rights of private property owners. But I don't think that he got down into details of when you compensate and when you don't. I think that if you read his writings, however, you do pull out a need for society's interests to be represented in how we govern and how we view property rights.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenberg, in the last paragraph of your the paper that we got, it reads, actually a fourth concern of the Farm Bureau is that some of the regulatory takings that might affect us the most were exempt from compensation. Can you give us an example of what you were thinking about there?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, speaking there of such things as Goal 5 overlays. You have big game habitat overlays. You're prevented from building fences in certain places. Stream setback, riparian corridors, those kinds of things that prevent you from using your land for what it's zoned to be used for. Those are the kinds of things that we had in mind, and the way I read Measure 7, those things would not be compensated under Measure 7.
You may.
The realtors in their testimony brought forth an interesting concept in using a variance as a compensation tool. With your background in following the land use policy discussions within the Farm Bureau Federation, how do you think they would react to that concept?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the variance concept would be something that we would be fairly concerned about in the agricultural community. Maybe it works all right inside the urban growth boundary, but outside the urban growth boundary, land use planning, the concept of land use planning is to prevent conflict, and there's different kinds of conflict that can happen. But if you grant a variance for everyone who wants a variance, pretty soon you don't have a pure zone anymore. I mean, we have a farm zone, but if you give everybody a variance to do what they want to do, because without that variance, that impairs their ability and their happiness somehow, pretty soon you don't have a farm zone left anymore.
Further questions for the panel? Representative Schrader.
Question on your testimony in both cases talks about the primary zoning being somewhat determinative, or primary use being compensable and non-farm uses being non-compensable. Part of, again, the thing I think this panel is trying to wrestle with was, at what point in time is that primary zoning established? And I guess, does Farm Bureau have any thoughts or opinion on that?
Chair, Representative Schrader, I think, we hear a lot about this fairness question, and I think the way I look at that is, what were the expectations of the landowner when they took that land? And I think that the hard part for this body, for this panel and this legislature, is that's going to depend on an individual basis as to when they came to ownership of that land. I think there's a very logical argument that maybe a property owner that bought farmland back in, say, 1970, with the expectations that they were going to farm this land for, you know, 30, 35 years, retire, and maybe sell it out to somebody wanting to build a homestead or something like home or some other use. That was probably a reasonable expectation back in 1970. But I would argue that since Senate Bill 100 and the comprehensive planning process has been adopted, it's not realistic for landowners to buy land in EFU zone, farm it for a certain period of time, and think somehow they're going to be able to change uses when they're ready to retire. So I think, I don't know if that's exactly on point with your question, but it certainly doesn't make your task easier. But I think it's what people are looking for with Measure 7 is somehow understanding that property rights are not absolute. We all understand that. We all live with that reality, whether we live in the city or the country. But when rights, when expectations are frustrated, that's when I think fairness dictates some sort of compensation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Lowe?
Tim, I think that's a very interesting comment. When expectations are frustrated, in Oregon law, there's a statute of limitations for everything. What if somebody had noticed long, long ago that the land was not going to be usable for their original intended purpose, and they did not take the opportunity to sell or find land that might have been better suited for their original intended purpose, or they failed somehow to find another use, a reasonable highest and best use for the land, and didn't mitigate their damages or didn't reduce their losses. They just hung on to it forever, hoping that things would change, and then things don't change. They've had notice for a long time, and they failed to act. Yet they're disappointed. Do you think that compensation should be due regardless of when the land was acquired, or if it was acquired by their grandfather with that expectation, or, you know, what parameters, what limitations would you think would be reasonable? I know a lot of those family farms have been kept in the, there's some 100-year century farms that are still in original ownership.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I think your point is an excellent one, and I think that, you know, maybe one of the ideas you look at is a change of ownership. I mean, if property has changed hands from generation to generation, certainly that new generation, one of the things that they had to figure when they stayed on the farm is the reality of what can that land be used for. And it's zoned since Senate Bill 100 and the comprehensive plans were adopted for farm use only. So certainly I think an argument of expectations, that there probably isn't a frustration of expectations in that instance. So I think it's a case-by-case situation. Your statute of limitation question, I think, is a little bit more difficult in that if an owner of property in 1970 had land out in a rural area, their chance of selling then or now, then meaning when the comprehensive planning process was established, through now, you couldn't do it ever. There was never a window of opportunity to do that, to maybe achieve some market value that you couldn't get with the zoning in place. So I don't know if that argument holds up as well as maybe the argument about changing ownership of the land to the next generation or whatever, or anyone else.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
I can understand how you might arrive at that, but what I'm thinking about is that they, perhaps they also had notice of an intended change and failed to act or protest or seek an exception or seek an opt-out, a complete failure, an acquiescence, in other words. At what point would a landowner acquiesce and waive their rights to ask for compensation at a later unforeseeable date?
Mr. Representative, I don't know. I think those are very interesting questions, and I just haven't thought about them. But I think that's obviously something probably ought to be considered.
Sleepless nights.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
Appreciate
you,
your time very much.
We're next going to ask Mitch Rose, representing the American Planning Association, to come forward for a couple of minutes. Then we're going to get to our other witnesses. And, committee, I'm hoping to try to bring this to a close somewhere around 5:30 if we can. Shut up, Kurt. Please
good evening, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Rose. I confess to being a planner. I've had counseling, but it didn't take. I've been a land use planner in Oregon since 1973, and I'm currently the vice president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, or OAPA, and I am speaking today on behalf of that association. I'll respect your wishes and all our wishes to get to dinner and move on here. I will spare you the pain of having me read through the multiple pages of testimony I have here, but I would just describe briefly what you're getting. There are three pieces of paper here. One is an OAPA position paper regarding Measure 7. This was written a couple of months ago by two very experienced planners in Oregon, Ed Sullivan and Arnold Kogan. And this is a broad philosophical piece, if you will, about planners' ideas and concerns on Measure 7 and the issue of compensation. The second one is a single page, front and back, recommendations for any legislation on compensation. This is a list of 20 provisions, recommendations, ideas for what we think any bill on compensation should include. And some of them are rather precise, and I won't go through them all here this evening by any means, but I hope you'll get a chance to spend at least a couple of minutes with the list. I hasten to add that we have a great many reservations about any legislation on this topic at all, and we're not suggesting that you go forward with legislation. But what we're saying here is that if you do, we think that a compensation bill should have these provisions in it. And finally, there's just a single piece of paper, what Senate Bill 100 said about compensation. And I drafted that this morning because I've heard in other legislative committees, and indeed I've heard over the years, a lot of discussion about how Senate Bill 100 called for compensation. It didn't. It called for a study of compensation issues by the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use, and they did that study. And here's what they reported in a letter to the legislative leadership in March 1986. Quote, "We found no evidence that local land use regulations have resulted in a taking of private property. In fact, Oregon's comprehensive land use planning system has provided Oregonians with assurance that their property will be protected against indiscriminate actions and conflicting uses that ultimately reduce the property their property values." And the relevant section of Senate Bill 100 that pertains to this is on the back at Section 24, so you can read for yourself what it said about the compensation issue. In the interest of time, I would simply offer three main points about what we would hope would be your course in pursuing any legislation on this matter. First of all, and I really hesitate to say this because I know that the reaction is going to be a planner asking for a study. Now, that's unusual. There is a great deal of misinformation swirling around about this issue. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, but very little statewide objective evidence on this point. And we think it would be very much worth your while to at least make some attempt to do some objective studies of this actual issue of devaluation of property. I've been in the position several times over the years of having to check out stories of devaluation and, in fact, try to find properties that had been devalued or had lost all of their value. And what I found is that there are often a great many extenuating circumstances that you may not expect. I remember I actually made some effort to find a property that had lost all of its value and consulted with a number of other local planners about who that might be, got what I thought was a really good story that I could follow up on about a fellow who couldn't build a house on his property out here in South Salem, met him on the property, fully prepared to hear his story, and there was a house sitting on the property. And I said, well, I thought that you had been told by the planners that you couldn't build on your property, and that was your concern. He said, well, that's what I have been told. They told me I couldn't build another house on my property. And in his mind, that was a taking. He had been denied the right to build a second house on his property. But I think a lot of people would suggest that that probably is not. But anyway, those are the types of things that we hope you would take a look at. We would ask for surgery rather than a shotgun approach to this. You've had, for example, today in the testimony, several statements about what Measure 7 was intended to address. You've heard consequences, unintended regulations, that was the problem. You've heard, relief from excessive regulations. You heard about providing compensation for unbuildable lands. Those are all very much different issues. And if you haven't identified the problem, it'll be very difficult, of course, to get precise legislation. Second thing we would ask is that you address the very real issue of administration, costs of administration and procedures for administration, as well as costs of compensation. And then that having assessed those, reevaluated those costs, that you specify an amount and a funding source, just as you do with the budgets that you're now considering for other state programs. Otherwise, the program for compensation will simply be a blank check, and that's a pretty scary proposition. If you, for example, read the 110 pages that the Attorney General gave us on his opinion about Measure 7, you'll find in there that one of the, what I think was an unintended consequence of that measure, was that it would affect the bottle bill, and that supermarkets could claim compensation under Measure 7 for the devaluation, the loss of value, the costs imposed upon them of handling bottles. Imagine for a moment how you would administer the claims from a few hundred, a few thousand, I don't know how many supermarkets there are in the state, but if all of those claims came in and there were no standards for the claims, it was simply up to the claimant to specify what they thought the appropriate amount was. Imagine how difficult that would be to administer it. And Measure 7 doesn't specify who would administer it or how that would happen, and that would be a very costly type of thing. We hope you'll address that. Finally, we think it's vital that any measure that you take not be retroactive. One of the concerns that we had, I never quite know whether to use past tense or present tense of Measure 7 because it's been found to be unconstitutional, but it's still being litigated. So one of the concerns that we had about Measure 7 is that it reaches back in time, in some cases many decades, to undo laws that have been on the books for a very long time. That introduces a lot of unpredictability, undoes a lot of programs that are vital to Oregon, and it also creates unfairness. For example, it may reach back, and if a waiver of regulation, for example, was allowed, which a lot of local governments have been talking about, it would mean that a person sitting in a residential zone with a vacant lot next to them, thinking that they're protected from a landfill or a junkyard or a pig farm locating there, might suddenly wake up one day and find one of those obnoxious land uses right next door to them and wonder where their protection had gone. And I think we want to avoid that type of unfairness and unintended consequence with any type of legislation. With that, I'll wrap up my testimony. I want to thank you very much for giving our organization the opportunity to comment today. As you can imagine, this is an issue that's pretty close to our hearts. And I would simply extend to you the opportunity to call on us anytime, and we will be as much help as we can, and we would be happy to work with you on legislation in this area. Thank you very much.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Afternoon, Mr. Rose.
Afternoon.
Your testimony was provocative in that it suggested to me that there might be something like a ripple effect of takings claims if the residential property owner suddenly awakens to find that the government has permitted a variance or under the realtor's dream or scheme of suggested solution or some variance that was granted or a waiver of regulation was granted by some planning commission, and thus their own property was devalued, then probably under ballot measure 7 they would have a claim as well. So we would have an endless ripple effect. I think that's what you're telling us.
Chair Williams and Representative Lowe, I think that's exactly right. And I think the reason for that is because Measure 7 and many of the other ideas for compensation that we've heard really address only one side of the coin, and that's the costs of regulation. They ignore the benefits of regulation. And what's sort of amusing about some of this to those of us that have been in planning for a long time is planning laws were developed in the first place to protect private property rights. And the whole idea was to protect the little vine-covered cottage from the great big smoky factory that might locate next door, to protect the value of that property. And the ironic consequence of something as broad as Measure 7 is that you might very well undo all of that protection. So, you know, we're very concerned that the value of regulation and the what the courts have called reciprocity of advantage, that that be considered. It's the idea of looking at the benefits as well as the costs. And to use perhaps an easier example, if you put a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit on truckers, that presumably costs them. If they could drive 80, they could make more deliveries a day, presumably make more money. On the other hand, they also presumably benefit from having speed limits on the freeway because they don't have people running them off the road. They don't get involved in as many accidents. They get an advantage from that speed limit, even though it imposes a cost on them also.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're now going to move into the public testimony. I'd like Dorothy English, Betsy Weimers, Margaret Cox, if they would come forward as a panel. We'll start out with Ms. English.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Dorothy English, and I reside at 13100 Northwest McNamee Road, Portland, Oregon, 97231. My husband and I bought 40 acres of view property in Multnomah County in the West Hills area, within a mile of the city limits of Portland. We bought it to live on and hold for investment purposes. It was then zoned for 2-acre parcel. It is not suitable for farming. It is mostly brush and deciduous trees. In 1971, we surveyed 20 of the acres into 6 3-acre parcels and 1 2-acre parcel for land division. However, after LCDC was established, we were downzoned. Multnomah County allowed us only 3 parcels. We sold an 11-acre parcel in 1974 and a 9-acre parcel a year or two later. My husband passed away in 1990. I now have 20 acres left. I would like to divide it into 5 parcels that would make great building lots with a view of Mount Hood and Mount Adams. I would like to have two of my grandchildren have two of the lots and sell three. I am 88 years old. I need the money I could get from the sale of these lots. I have very limited means and rely primarily on Social Security. Multnomah County will not let me divide the property as I could have done when we bought it. It is zoned commercial forest, even though it isn't suitable for commercial forest purposes. I'm not even on forest deferral. The county also put overlay restrictions on the property to protect scenic values and wildlife habitat. Metro has acquired nearby land for green spaces. Clearly, the highest and best use of this property is for small rural view home sites. There are already about 70 homes nearby along McNamee Road. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. English. We'll go ahead and have all three of the panelists speak before we go to questions. Ms. Weimers?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Betty Weimers. My address is 39921 Church Road, Fall Creek, Oregon, 97438. My husband and I bought 132 acres of rural land in Lane County in 1963 at a time when there were no regulations restricting land divisions or dwellings on the property. Fortunately, we were able to sell off a portion of this acreage in the early 70s after my husband suffered a massive heart attack in 1969 and had open heart surgery in 1971. We couldn't operate the entire place without his help and had to pay major medical bills. After my husband recovered, we struggled to operate the remaining acreage along with some small parcels we were able to lease, primarily for hay, wheat, and pasture, which were low-valued uses of the land. Over the years, we have tried to support our family in every way we could by raising quarter horses, feeder calves, and sheep, but we were not able to do so. To make ends meet, my husband went to work for Safari Motor Coaches. My husband passed away in 1999, and I am now 75 years old. My primary source of income is Social Security. I'm on the verge of losing the 20 acres I have left if I'm not able to divide it and sell some of it. We could have divided and sold parts of it when we bought in 1962, but I can't now because of the land use regulations that have zoned it into an exclusive farm use zone. It doesn't allow any land division, and the exceptions process is so rigid, I have been denied the opportunity to change the zone to a rural residential zone, which would be far more appropriate for this land. The land is surrounded by 86 small parcels with 77 houses within 1 mile of my property. This parcelization occurred long before county zoning was put in place. There are no commercial farms in the area, and my 20 acres is not a profitable commercial operation. It is best suited for small parcel rural living. It is too big for most rural residents who work away from the property and too small to be used for the limited farming it can accommodate. I understand that I would be eligible to make a claim under Measure 7. I don't want compensation, but I do want to be able to do what I could have done when my late husband and I bought the property, divide and sell off small rural parcels. This would not only help me financially and allow me to continue living in my home of 46 years, but it would provide needed opportunities for rural living in an area which is entirely consistent with other nearby land. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Weimers. Ms. Cox.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Marguerite Cox. I live at 15450 South Henry C. Road in Oregon City. I am here today to testify in support of Measure 7. My late husband and I purchased 49 acres in Clackamas County in 1958. We have been raising miniature horses on the land for over 40 years. We have supported ourselves over the years with income from raising horses and from being able to sell land as we needed additional income. Also, we expected our land to provide for our retirement. I am now 86 years old and have heart problems. I desperately need to sell some land so that I can have money to live on and to carry on with my horse raising on a reduced schedule, utilizing some hired help. I have no other income except Social Security. I cannot divide and sell off a 10-acre parcel because the new 20-acre minimum urban reserve recently adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission. The land was zoned rural residential long after we bought the land. It did allow 5-acre parcels up until they increased the minimum parcel size to 20 acres. There was no zoning on our land when we bought it. I have always believed that buying and paying off our farm was a safe way to provide for our retirement, and now government is robbing me of that investment and retirement. I was glad to see that Measure 7 passed to provide protection for people like us. Now I hear that people are trying to stop it. That's wrong. I urge you to do what you can to make it work. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cox. Are there any questions for this panel?
I have questions.
Representative Lowe.
Mrs. Cox, can you tell me which piece of Henrisi you live on? Are you on the piece between Beaver Creek and Molalla, or are you on the piece between Beaver Creek and Redland Road?
We're right at the corner of Beaver Creek and Henrisi Road. Henrisi crosses it, Beaver Creek, as it comes out from Oregon City.
Right.
And we're right on the corner. We go up along Henrisi Road.
Okay. Are you on the north or south side of that corner?
It'd be the south side of the road.
Okay. The only reason I ask that question is that that's the dividing line between mine and the good representative seated a few seats over there, the district. And I'm familiar with that area because I know there's been a lot of development out there.
Mm-hmm.
It has development surrounded you?
Has it what?
Surrounded you.
Yes. There's houses on all sides of us.
Are there any other large parcels adjacent to you or near you that are not developed?
Oh, I don't think so.
Trying to picture the area. Thank you, Mrs. Cox.
Well, if you come out Beaver Creek Road and turn right on Henrisi, it's the first place on the left-hand side.
I want to go just to see the miniature horses.
Thank you. Now you mention it, she's got some great horses out there.
Okay. Thank you very much, ladies. Mm-hmm. We appreciate you being here today. Next, Gilbert Shibley and also Paula Crane from the League of Women Voters, if you two would come up.
Not here.
Huh? Mr. Shibley, is Mr. Shibley here?
I don't see him.
Okay.
He was.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we missed him. So, Ms. Crane.
I thought maybe you'd call someone else also. But... Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Paula Crane, president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League has a long history of support for Oregon State Land Use Planning Program, and for the protection of the health, welfare, and safety of Oregon citizens. The League opposed ballot Measure 7 in November of 2000. Since its passage, the League has closely followed the issues raised by Measure 7, including its constitutionality, procedural, and process issues.
We are pleased that this body is taking a serious look resolving the issues raised by Measure 7. The League supports the Speaker's principles, and in particular we support maintaining the integrity of Oregon's land use planning program, clarification of the issues, and especially public participation. We would like to suggest that the committee add one principle, and this has been stated before today. Identify revenue sources required to pay for qualifying claims. The League also suggests that determining the intent of the voters at this time is likely impossible. We hope that the committee will avoid this potential black hole. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address your committee regarding our concerns. We would be pleased to work with your committee in its exploration of the many issues involved.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crane, you say that we should identify revenue sources available. We've heard testimony today and also the last time we met from landowners who say they don't want compensation. They want to be able to use the investment that they bought years ago, paid taxes on, took care of, to take care of themselves now so they don't have to be reliant on government, such as the three ladies we just saw. Why can't we allow them some flexibility to do that? Why do we have to go the compensation route, in your view?
Well, we're not saying that you have to go that route for every single one of these. But if you maintain the goal of maintaining the integrity of our land use process, then you have to find a way around maintaining that as well as satisfying their needs and deciding what you will have to decide what is the best way to do that, whether you're going to make it, you know, change the land use laws and say all of those that were not in effect before 1974, you know, people can, you know, if they own that property. But that's going to be your decision, how you can come up with allowing these people to do what, you know, what they think they need to do without hurting the integrity of our land use process.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
At this time, we will adjourn the committee. Appreciate everyone being here this evening and for your testimony, and we'll give you notice when our next meeting is scheduled.